This is London calling North America. London letter this week is by Patrick Kirwan, well-known writer and journalist on the Evening Standard staff here in London. And in this talk, he speaks about Mr. Attlee, Mr. Bevan, and Mr. Morrison.
The morning after the general election, every newspaper man in the country was eager to see how the dramatic news of Mr. Churchill's defeat had been taken by the rest of the world. I'm a political journalist and flatter myself I know something about politics. But, like myself, it was amazed. Some American newspapers even saw it as an act of rank ingratitude towards our great war leader. Actually, it was nothing of the kind. No one in Britain commands greater respect and veneration than Mr. Churchill. The election marked a return to the country's traditional two-party system and the right of the sovereign people to choose between them, in this case, the Labour Party. When British democracy feels that one party has held office long enough, that it is in danger of becoming flabby or complacent, they put in the other party at the next general election. This is the process, familiar enough to Mr. Churchill, known as the swing of the pendulum. If during the next 5 years the Labour Party fails to give a satisfactory account of themselves, no doubt the pendulum will swing again, and there will be another Conservative government with, it is quite possible, Mr. Churchill again at its head. Actually, the defeated Conservatives had held office, with slight interruptions, for nearly 20 years. In the time of our greatest danger, the Dunkirk period, they had formed a coalition government with the Labour Party and carried the war in Europe to a victorious conclusion. But the British notoriously disliked coalitions, so they held an election and decided to give the Labour Party its first real chance. The late Parliament had sat 10 years, one of the longest in our history. Its members were getting old. The people felt it needed new blood, men and women from the services and industry, with newly gained experience of the problems of the Empire and Commonwealth, and new ideas of how industry should develop. Like good sportsmen, they'd like to give everyone a chance. Now the Labour Party has it. As a matter of fact, both parties are united on the main matters of policy to be affected during the coming years. The sternest possible prosecution of the war against Japan, full employment, social security, the provision of houses for the bombed out and the returning servicemen, and the rebuilding of our shattered cities. They differ only on the proportion of state to free enterprise to be used in these tasks. The Labour Party have no intention of abolishing free enterprise. They will encourage it where it is efficient and of service to the community. But they want state control of the railways, mines, and public utilities. Here again, it must be remembered that to all practical intents and purposes, these have been under a kind of state control during the war period, and a more formal extension of it shouldn't bring any abrupt changes in the life of the country. So in the main, the people have given the Labour Party the opportunity of carrying out a programme of reconstruction approved by everyone. Nor does Mr. Churchill's defeat mean that it means that he vanishes from the political scene. Not at all. He becomes head of the opposition, and that, in the British House of Commons, is a position of high consequence. It is known as the leader of His Majesty's opposition, and it carries a salary with it. The duty of the opposition is to oppose. And as all the world knows, Mr. Churchill is a formidable opponent. Now, it is true that Mr. Attlee is not the stature nor the powers of oratory of the great man he has succeeded. He is modest and unassuming, and has none of Winston Churchill's glamour. Nor is he, like Mr. Churchill, an aristocrat, but a typical representative of the solid middle class whose votes have so greatly helped to put the Labour Party into power. He comes of a prosperous family of lawyers and enjoyed all the advantages that a good assured income gives. As a boy, with a lofty brow and a shy, gentle manner, he went to a good public school, which, being in England, is not public at all, but strictly private and reserved for the sons of gentlemen. He was a brilliant scholar at Haileybury, a reputation he kept up later at University College, Oxford, where he took his degree. Oddly enough, at this time, in the early part of the century, he was a strong imperialist and conservative, and could look forward to a great legal career as a member of the honourable profession of the bar, which means as an attorney. Then came one of those strange conversions to the cause of the working people, which are not uncommon among what might be called the British upper class. It has been said that in England, for every socialist created by Das Kapital, thousands have been created by the Bible. It was in Britain that industry, the machine age, was born. That was over 100 years ago. And its mushroom growth left this country a slum problem that is only in our day being finally overcome. Clement Attlee turned his back on the glittering prizes of the legal world and began to devote his life to the welfare of the slum dwellers of the East End of London. Later, now a convinced socialist, he became secretary of Toynbee Hall and then lecturer at Ruskin College, working class places of education which have turned out many brilliant labor leaders and scholars. Then the First World War broke out. As is usual when Britain is threatened, all political differences were immediately sunk. Clement Attlee volunteered for the army. He distinguished himself in Mesopotamia, Gallipoli, and France, rising to the rank of major. He was severely wounded, but with the war's end, returned with renewed energy to labor politics. Now, after experiencing the full horrors of war, he so hated it that he became a pacifist and threw himself wholeheartedly into the No More War movement. He became the first labor mayor of Stepney, then its representative in Parliament. And with that engaging eccentricity that marks English political life, the pacifist was made war minister during the brief Labour administration of 1929 to 31. Then came the long years on the opposition benches in Parliament. But in the meantime, he became the leader of the Labour Party. Here you must understand that the Labour Party is formed of two bodies, the trade unions and the purely political party. There is always something of a struggle for the leadership between these two wings. And Clem Attlee was elected as a safe man while the issue was fought out. He has held the position ever since. And although he has been assailed by occasional extremists as being overcautious and lacking fire, it is a tribute to his quiet strength that today no one would dream of trying to oust him. He is no stranger to the business of being Prime Minister. All through the wartime coalition, he has acted as Mr. Churchill's deputy. That the coalition held so well together, despite its political differences, is due in no small measure to his tact and level-headedness. He will run his new team with the same assurance. The people of Britain like Clem Attlee. There is no side about him. He lives in a modest suburban house, smokes a pipe, and likes digging in his garden at the weekend. Whoever called the British a nation of shopkeepers was wrong. They are a nation of gardeners. His wife is just as unassuming as himself. She runs the house and takes her place in the shopping queue together with the other housewives of the village. They have three daughters, two in the services like the rest of the young women of Britain, and one at school. Now Mrs. Attlee is busy taking over number 10 Downing Street. Mr. Herbert Morrison, number two of the big three in the new British government, is a Cockney born and bred. His appointment as Lord President of Council, which means that he is in effect responsible for the reconstruction of Britain, would seem a far cry for a London policeman's son. It has not been given him as a reward for the Labour Party victory. He was chief organiser of the electoral campaign, but because of his undoubted ability as an administrator. This Cockney office boy has all the sprightly impudence of that famous race. He is below average height, dresses neatly, and is readily distinguishable by the quiff that can occasionally bristle like the cock's comb when he's roused. He has served London all his life. In 1920, he was mayor of Hackney. 3 years later, he was representing that borough in Parliament and served as Minister of Transport in the 1929 Labour government. Here, he was as successful an organiser as he had been in the London County Council. In fact, he was that ill-fated government's outstanding success. Herbert Morrison is a socialist largely, I suspect, because he considers capitalism inefficient. His approach to it is businesslike, not emotional. He calculated shrewdly that it was no use preaching socialism to the middle classes as though it were a new religion. They had to be shown it would benefit them materially, and that it would neither interfere with their property nor their privileges. Now, Herbert Morrison loves London and will hear no word against it. From his earliest years, he's middle-aged now, he has campaigned to win London for Labour. It was he who really created the London Labour Party, and it was he who led it from a struggling minority to a triumphant majority at the local elections for the London County Council in 1934. Ever since then, London has had a Labour administration with Herbert Morrison as its driving force. Now, Mr. Ernest Bevin is the last, but by no means the least, of the new government's big three. It is to the cause of trade unionism that, until lately, he has devoted his life. His greatest achievement in this field has been the organization of the Transport and General Workers Union of Great Britain. the greatest in the world.
Under his guidance, it has topped the million mark in paid-up membership.
And here again, it must be remembered that trade unionism in Britain is not looked upon as some kind of conspiracy against the state, but as an essential factor in its smooth working. Through its negotiations, unnecessary strikes are largely avoided, and working conditions regulated through direct contact with employers. Britain, the home of modern industry, would be unthinkable without its other offspring, the trades unions. As I have said, it is in this activity that Ernie, the familiar Ernie, is again an unmistakable sign of his popularity, that Ernie Bevan has acquired his undoubted experience. He is no politician in the sense that Clem Attlee and Herbert Morrison are. His one attempt to enter Parliament under the Labour ticket before was unsuccessful. But when the wartime coalition was formed, his presence in the government was felt indispensable. He was elected by one of those skillful compromises at which the British are so adept into Parliament and made Minister of Labour. Now, Britain is a small island. At that time, it stood alone against the whole of Hitler's might. It was his task to mobilise every man and woman of the island nation and direct them to their posts. The British don't like being ordered about, but this blunt, massive man successfully directed every man from Duke to Dustman, from Countess to Charwoman, into either industry or the forces. For 6 years, he controlled the destinies of 25 million people. There's no use for those who think a refined accent and a university education are indispensable to the post. He knows the world has changed, and that diplomacy is no longer a matter of discreet dinners and magnificent court balls. It is, in his opinion, a matter of forthright speaking and straight dealing. As a trade union leader, he has toured the world, conducted negotiations all over the continent, and made his massive presence felt, even in the League of Nations. He has been successful. He sees no reason why, if in the cause of trade unionism he did well, he cannot do better in the cause of the whole country and all mankind. He's tough, even with his friends in the labor movement. He is no less likely to be tough where the interests of Britain are concerned. These, then, are the three main figures in the new government. They are a team, united in a political philosophy. But of one thing the world may remain certain. They are British, firm believers that the British Commonwealth of Nations offers a pattern of democratic freedom to the world, and determined that they will uphold its traditions and add to its renown.
You have been listening to Patrick Kirwin. Next week, MacDonald Hastings will be back from Ireland, and he'll be writing you his usual London letter. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.